Hello and welcome to the Learning College. I'm Alex Linder. You can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com. Today we're going to resume with Kevin MacDonald's A People That Shall Dwell Alone, Judaism as a Group Evolutionary Strategy. And we're talking about, in today's segment, genetic and cultural segregation among the Sephardic Jews in the medieval period. So the general topic is genetic and cultural segregation of Jews. And we dealt with some of that last segment, and we're going to deal with more of it today. We're only going to do about 10-11 pages, 127 to 138, just to keep stuff a little bit shorter and quicker moving. Let's dig in. Page 127, genetic and cultural segregation among the Sephardic Jews in the medieval period. So how the Jews keep themselves apart in their genes through their, as we've heard, uncle-niece marriages and first-cousin marriages, inbreeding, and through their various cultural practices. You know, the 613 commandments they're supposed to live by. Genetic and cultural segregation among the Sephardic Jews in the medieval period. Baer emphasizes the continuity of Sephardic customs and beliefs from practices originating in the ancient world. There remained a consistent trend in Jewish religious thought in the Middle Ages that depicted Jews as a chosen people living among hostile nations. So this depicting themselves as poor victims living among people who hate them is going on at least since the Middle Ages. Basically, as long as they've existed, they portrayed themselves as victims. There remained a consistent trend in Jewish religious thought in the Middle Ages that depicted Jews as a chosen people. For example, Judah Halevi, H-A-L-E-V-I, in the 12th century. Beginning in the 13th century, the 1200s, a long series of Kabbalistic writings created, quote, a new mystically clothed ethnic concept. Kabbalists created a new mystical ethnic concept, close quote, in which the non-Jewish world was viewed as evil, and any compromise or assimilation with it was rejected. The worst behavior of all was to enter into intimacy with Gentile women. Quote, Jewish pietism, with its overtones of mysticism, deepened the sense of foreignness embedded in the consciousness of a people living in exile in strange lands. Later, in the 15th century and beyond, the records of the Iberian Inquisitions, quote, breathe a nostalgic yearning for the national homeland, both earthly and heavenly, a yearning for all things, great and small, sanctified by the national tradition. All the references are to Baer, B-A-E-R. Maintaining racial purity among the medieval Sephardim. The Sephardim is Spanish or Iberian Peninsula, right? Refers to Spain and Portugal. Sephardic Spanish Jews, basically. The medieval Sephardic Jewish community was greatly concerned with providing and enforcing communal sanctions aimed at preventing Gentile contamination of the Jewish gene pool. We have already noted that Maimonides, whose views were authoritative, had a very negative attitude regarding having sexual intercourse with Gentile slaves and/or converting them. Don't fuck them, don't convert them. Leave them alone. They're negative. They're, well, other than mulcting them and cheating them and stealing from them and hating on them in your writings, leave them alone, other than those. Baer gives many examples of rabbinic writing that indicate disapproval of sexual relationships with Gentiles, as in the following. Quote, intercourse with a slave woman is a capital sin, for the sinner defiled the holiness of God by loving and possessing the daughter of an alien god. His alien offspring will be a snare to him and a reminder of his sin. Kabbalistic writers, citing Hosea 5:7, railed against those who, quote, have betrayed the Lord by begetting alien offspring, and further, quote, he who lies with a Gentile woman, of this is it written, And the people began to have illicit relations with the daughters of Moab, and the anger of the Lord blazed against Israel. From the Sefer HaZohar, see Bear, 1961. Neumann provides an opinion of a medieval Jewish court in Spain that two individuals were, quote, of pure descent, without any family taint, and that they could intermarry with the most honored families in Israel, for there has been no admixture of impure blood in the paternal or maternal antecedents and their collateral relatives. In this case, two brothers had been accused of having a slave as an ancestor, and the charge was so serious that the accused, quote, could not rest with the verdict of the local rabbis and invoke the aid of all the prominent rabbis in their vicinity, begging them to confirm with the weight of the authority the sentence already pronounced. Quote, the entire responsum is charged with deep emotion. The fact that a blemish had been cast on an innocent family in Israel was regarded with horror as an act of monstrous villainy. How dare you call my Jewish pedigree, my pure Jewish blood, into question? These are the people that encourage us into mongrelization and disregarding our ancestors and saying, calling our genitals junk and calling our ancestors, calling ourselves mutts, European mutts. They encourage all that. Notice also that even collateral relatives were examined. Having impure blood cast a shadow over the entire family, not only on the direct line of descent. Offspring of female slaves received, quote, grudging social recognition and tolerance, the master freeing the slave, converting her to Judaism, and then engaging in a semi-marriage, presumably similar during the period of the Inquisition. So these Jews are running from one end of the Mediterranean in Spain to the other in Turkey, and sometimes they're having their Gentile slaves being brought along with them. Neumann also finds that the Jewish authorities were greatly concerned with discouraging any sexual relationships between Jews and Gentiles. They dealt severely with a Jewish offender. In one instance, when a Jewish woman gave birth to a child by a Christian man, two rabbis concurred that her nose should be cut off. Brundage notes that Mosaic law forbade Jewish women from prostitution, but that foreign prostitutes were tolerated. However, this stricture was not always obeyed, and some authorities distinguished between prostitution within the Jewish community and outside it. Quote, some later authorities argued that even a priest might marry a Jewish harlot, provided that in the course of her career, she had not had sexual relations with any Gentiles, slaves, members of her own household, or married men of any kind. Brundage. Flipping to 130. Community enforcement of separation among the medieval Sephardim. Community enforcement of separation. Medieval/medieval Sephardim. In Chapter 1, it was noted that an essential feature of any group evolutionary strategy is to develop mechanisms that prevent individuals from self-interested behavior, which conflicts with group goals. As noted above, Jewish diaspora communities, beginning in the ancient world, were characterized by powerful internal governments, which aggressively monitored individual behavior and ensured conformity with group interests. Make sure that every single individual Jew is not doing something that hurts the group. In Spain, prior to the expulsion of 1492, there was a strong separation between the Jewish Alhamas, usually in Spanish the second to last syllable is stressed, A-L-J-A-M-A-S. There was a strong separation between the Jewish Alhamas and the rest of society. This residential segregation was not rigidly maintained or legally imposed until after the destruction of many Jewish communities in 1391, after which residents in a juderia, a Jewry, became compulsory in some areas. Nevertheless, even in the absence of residential segregation, all Jews were under the authority of the Alhama government, as was also the case in Poland. Besides the physical separation, the Alhamas were fiscally separate from the surrounding communities and were governed by Jewish religious law, rather than the common law of the land, imperia in imperio. As the rabbi said, quote, God forbid that the holy people should walk in the ways of the Gentiles and according to their statutes. Would they teach their children the laws of the Gentile and build themselves altars of the uncleanliness of the heathen? The judicial and legislative powers of the Al-Hamas represented a potent means of social control within the community. Any Jew who attempted to avoid the Jewish courts and proceedings against other Jews was viewed as an informer and was subjected to severe discipline, including excommunication and heavy fines. In conjunction with the royal authorities, prosecuted violations of religious practices, such as the regulations concerning the Sabbath. There were less formal mechanisms of social control as well. A particularly interesting aspect of community control over individual behavior relates to the prevention of apostasy. Writing of 13th century Spain, Baer notes that measures were taken to protect converts to Christianity from abuse by their former co-religionists. The interesting thing is that conversion was, quote, a blot on the family. The disgrace of one convert in a family was enough to warrant the disruption of the wedding engagement of an innocent relative. His former brethren regarded him as a renegade and ostracized him. Close quote. This type of social control in which relatives were penalized for individual behavior and contravention of group norms was common throughout Jewish history. Goetain, writing of the medieval Islamic times, notes that the responsibility of the extended family was recognized by public opinion, although it was not a formal part of Jewish law. Hundert, or Hundert, notes that in traditional Ashkenazi society, the son of a convert was ostracized and ridiculed because of his father's apostasy, indicating that conversion had negative effects in the entire family, even beyond the immediate generation. Andeshen, or D-E-S-H-E-N, describes a 19th century Moroccan case in which a man was allowed to break an engagement with a woman whose aunt had given birth out of wedlock. The decision was based on a precedent in which a man was allowed to break an engagement with a woman whose sister had converted to Islam. The following Takhanan of the Synod of Frankfurt illustrates well how community controls over individual behavior related to cultural separatism were linked to penalties on other family members. Quote, if it is proven that any Jew has drunk wine in the house of a Gentile, it shall be forbidden for any other Jew to marry his daughter, or to give him lodging, or to call him to the Torah, or to allow him to perform any religious function. Quoted in Finkelstein, 1924. The same synod established penalties for avoiding Jewish charity, which included the exclusion of children from the community. These social controls on individual behavior facilitated the group strategy because an individual contemplating apostasy or other major breaches of the rules would realize that the consequences of such an act would accrue not only to himself, but also to the relatives left behind, thus raising the stakes considerably. There is, of course, an excellent evolutionary logic embedded in such controls. Individuals are implicitly assumed to take into account the cost of their actions on their relatives. The practice of cultural separatism among the Sephardim. Interestingly, the Sephardic Jews are credited by Roth with pioneering the discarding of external signs of Jewish separateness, such as clothing and language. 35. And Castro notes that Jews often lived among non-Jews rather than in exclusively Jewish quarters, the Juderia, as it's called in Spain, or the Jewish quarter. Nevertheless, the Sephardic lack of concern with external signs of separateness was highly compatible with a strong sense of exclusivity. The dietary laws, circumcision, the practice of the Sabbath, and the mitzvah of 613 commandments in general would be expected to result in a profound sense of being a Jew and being separated from Gentile society. It should be noted that the Sephardic sense of exclusivity and superiority is legendary, even among the other branches of Judaism. After the expulsion After the expulsion, the Sephardim continued to use a dialect of archaic Spanish, Ladino, L-A-D-I-N-O, in their communities in other parts of the world, so that in the 19th century, most Sephardic Jews living in the Turkish Empire could understand neither Turkish or other local languages, such as Greek and Romanian. In Morocco, the Sephardic Jews continued to speak a Castilian dialect, which differed from Ladino until the 19th century. Benardite, B-E-N-A-R-D-E-T-E, 1953, Benardite emphasizes that, in addition to this, quote, secretive language for communication among co-religionists, there was a wide variety of other religious customs, gestures, celebrations, and culinary laws that separated them from Gentiles and even other Jews living among them. Benardite cites observations indicating that the Sephardim in the United States considered themselves, quote, a people apart, with, quote, hermetic groupings, and superior to Ashkenazi Jews, even though they were of lower social class than the latter, whom they referred to with the derogatory term Tedesco, which in Italian means Germans, German Jews, that were the predominant Jews in the U.S. and semi-assimilated and were later supplanted by Russian Jews after 1880. In Morocco, the Sephardim remained separate for the most part from the native Jews, for whom they used the disdainful term forasteros, or aliens. This is perhaps an appropriate place to mention the general phenomenon of linguistic separatism among the Jews. Patai notes that from the Middle Ages to at least the 19th century, there has been a strong trend for linguistic separatism, characterized typically by Jews clinging to archaic native languages to which they added Hebrew words. Examples are Ladino, Yiddish, Judeo-Persian, Hebrew, Aramaic, Arabic, hyphenated, triple. The result was that in many areas, such as Poland, on the eve of World War I, the great majority of Jews could not communicate in the language of the Gentiles. So where there's the greatest number of Jews, like Russia and Poland, they don't speak Polish, for Christ's sakes. In addition, Hebrew, the holy tongue, quote-unquote, remained throughout the ages as a language of written and often oral communication among Jews. Hebrew was a prominent sign of Jewish separatism in the medieval period, viewed by Christians as a, quote, hidden language, unquote, all the more mysterious because of the rabbinic prohibition on teaching the language to Gentiles. Clearly, linguistic separatism has been an important force for maintaining genetic and cultural separation between Jews and Gentiles over a very long period of historical time. Next segment, genetic and cultural segregation among the Ashkenazim in the traditional societies of Eastern Europe. So turning from the Sephardics to the Ashkenazi. Block quote, Russian Jews never seem for an instant to lose the consciousness that they are a race apart. It is in their walk, their sidelong glance, in the carriage of their sloping shoulders, in the curious gesture of the uplifted palm. This is from Harold Frederick, The New Exodus, Israel and Russia, London, 1892, 79-80, quoted in Lindemann, 1991, 129, maybe Esau's Tears, it's quoted in, I suspect. As I began to reconstruct the life of my grandfather's family, begins the second epigraph, quite long, I received the distinct impression that the life of my grandfather and that of the Hungarian peasants of Pata had almost nothing in common. The contact between my grandparents and the peasants of the village was confined to the occasions when the latter stopped by the store to make their small purchases. Apart from this, my grandfather lived entirely in the world of Jewish tradition, primarily that of the Talmud. He knew almost nothing of the cultural traditions of the Pata peasants. Both grandfather's and grandmother's clothing was different, so were their hairstyles and the food they ate, and because of the strict separation between the ethos of the one and of the other, one reaches the conclusion that this Hungarian Jew lived in practically complete cultural isolation from his purely Hungarian environment among the Ashkenazi Jews. The principal barriers included physical appearance, attitudes, language, residential propinquity, and social relationships. Jews tended to live in the same neighborhoods, whether in the ghetto imposed by the authorities or in self-chosen segregated neighborhoods near the synagogue. As was the case throughout the diaspora from ancient times, Jews lived under their own laws derived from the Talmud and organized their own communities. Indeed, even when the ghetto was imposed by the Gentile authorities, quote, many rabbis would have liked the walls of the ghetto higher. Any contact at all between Jew and Gentile was more or less deemed a departure from a theoretical ideal. Quote, had it been practically feasible, complete segregation from the outside world would have been desirable. The Jewish quarter lived a life of its own, in which society at large had no part. Jewish education was, quote, introverted and singular, devoted exclusively to Jewish studies. Jews spoke a different language, Yiddish, at least among themselves, and, as noted above, on the eve of World War I, the Jewish masses of Poland did not understand Polish. That's how separate they were. They didn't know Polish. Those least likely to know the language of the highest prestige in the Jewish community, the rabbis. An edict of the Russian government that every rabbi learn the Russian language was avoided by several subterfuges, including abandoning the distinctive hat of the rabbi in public. In 19th century Lithuania, quote, the study of European languages was seen as unnecessary and even dangerous. Regarding physical appearance, Weinrib notes that, quote, Jews in Western countries mostly wore clothes that distinguished them from non-Jews, possibly at first for religious reasons, as a barrier against the outside world. Besides clothing, Katz also notes that men and women wore their hair differently, and there were perhaps even differences in their physiognomy, which was, quote, somehow more distinct rapprochement. Even the shape of their faces was different. Regarding attitudes, the Jews viewed themselves as separate, even from the land. Many rabbis viewed Poland itself as defiled and unclean and not a permanent habitat of the Jews. Reflecting this sense of sojourning, the burial service in traditional Ashkenazi shtetl communities included depositing a small amount of soil from Palestine under the head of the deceased. Katz, 1961, that Jews were conscious of being only temporary resident aliens. Temporary resident aliens, and were considered in this manner by Gentiles. There was also a powerful sense of separation from Gentiles. Katz describes the common philosophical belief among Jews that Judaism and Christianity differed not merely in matters of ritual and belief, but also in essence. Moreover, this essential difference was often viewed as ultimately the result of racial differences. With Jews descending from Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, while the Gentiles descended from Esau, who was tricked out of his birthright by Jacob. And you know I've remarked many times how funny it is that these Christians will name their kids Jacob, but never Esau. Social contacts between Jews and Gentiles were to remain to cultivation of personal attachments, entertainment, and fraternization. That's Katz. Practices that were even more strictly enforced later than they were in the medieval period. Dietary laws prevented Jews from eating at Gentile homes so that, quote, only on rare formal occasions did Jew and Gentile invite each other. Religious authorities inveighed against even these occurrences, however exceptional. These barriers had the expected effect of preventing marriage with non-Jews. Freikorps characterizes the Ashkenazi Jews as an, quote, extremely religious, cohesive, endogamous group who were extremely selective in choosing marriage partners according to biblical, Talmudic, and rabbinical precepts, including, as already noted, a preference for uncle-niece marriages. Throughout the Jewish settlement in Poland, there was a very low level of assimilation via conversion, and especially forced conversion. Voluntary conversions were small in number, and most involved poor and obscure Jews. There were forced conversions, as well as conversions of convenience of Jews in Poland. However, there were also laws preventing reconversion to Judaism of those who had converted to Christianity, suggesting controls on, quote, conversions of conscience, and an attempt to prevent crypto-Judaism, i.e. Muranos in Poland, whatever they would be called. However, many of these converts succeeded in returning to Judaism after the danger had passed, and some converts continued to maintain their relationships with their Jewish relatives and other Jews after conversion, suggesting crypto-Judaism. So they fake convert to ease the social pressure, but they remain Jews at heart, and in fact, there are indications that when, which is obvious if Judaism is a race, there are indications that when Jews converted to Christianity, they were able to rapidly intermarry with Poles, indicating that the barriers to intermarriage were mainly erected by Jews, not Poles. For example, Chikanowiki describes a wealthy Jewish family that converted and attained important places in the aristocracy and was able to make very good marriages with other aristocrats. Intermarriages, though rare, were not scandalous. Indeed, as was the case in England, at least until the end of the 18th century, there is evidence that intermarriage following religious conversion tended to occur only within the highest stratum of the Gentile population. Jews in Poland actively resisted assimilationist attempts by non-Jews resulting from the ideology of the Enlightenment, Brotherhood of Mankind, One World, Globalism. Enlightenment intellectuals advocated giving Jews complete access to economic activity, including state service, but called for an end to the, quote, damaging Jewish monopoly in trade and finance. These ideas were rejected by Jewish and Polish conservatives alike, the latter advocating emancipation of Jews only after they had assimilated. Emancipation, quote, did not initiate a marked assimilation trend. The assimilative trend, this is a quote, which grew noticeably among Polish Jews in the second half of the 19th century, slackened or even came to a halt in later times. Footnote 39, endnote. Moreover, from the present perspective, the precise meaning of assimilation is important. Barriers such as clothing and language are important to viewing Judaism as a fairly closed group evolutionary strategy, only insofar as they are means toward the ends of genetic segregation. However, it is quite possible that these barriers could fall, but that genetic segregation, as well as resource and reproductive competition between ethnic groups, could continue. So no matter what the law says, they still are able to maintain their distance, keep their distance, keep their segregation, keep their marriages and births and intercourse to themselves, if purely by social custom, reinforced bonds and ideology coming from the rabbis and believed, accepted, and practiced by the Jews themselves. Indeed, Lichten notes the broad range of Jewish assimilationist positions in Poland from the late 19th century to the pre-World War II period, the vast majority of which were consistent with continued genetic segregation and resource competition. For example, an assimilationist organization in 1937 expressed patriotic sentiments for the Polish state, as well as support for the idea that all citizens be treated according to their personal accomplishments, regardless of religion or national origin. By themselves, these proposals would clearly not be sufficient to end genetic segregation and resource competition based on ethnicity. In fact, if such a program, which essentially corresponds to the official position of Reform Judaism, see below, had been implemented, it is quite possible that the result would have been to intensify ethnically based resource competition, on the assumption that complete emancipation of the Jews would result in their being better able to compete with Gentiles. Evidence for this latter proposal is presented in chapter 5. And that's where we'll leave it off today, so that, yeah, it doesn't matter which end of the Mediterranean you chase them to, they're still going to stick to themselves, they're still going to see themselves as a part, they're not going to assimilate, and then when you actually let them out, they run riot because they're networked, and then they can start truly taking advantage of the vast and manifold opportunities that genetic nepotism makes possible. Anyway, thanks for being with me today. I've been Alex Linder, reading out of A People That Shall Dwell Alone, Kevin MacDonald's book about Judaism as a group evolutionary strategy. And you can find this and all we record as part of the Learning College, the stuff you can't get from the mainstream newspapers or mainstream accredited schools, at vnnforum.com. I'll be back with you again real soon. We'll do more from Kevin MacDonald.